about to tell you about it.
Thanks.
There was no appreciable irony in her tone. An internment camp teaches you things about the value of not knowing. Don't mention it.
And what about silencing us after the event?
I spread my hands. What for? Mandrake isn't interested in silence. This'll be the biggest coup a single corporate entity has ever pulled off. It'll want it known. Those time-locked data launches, we said, are going to be the oldest news on the block when they finally decay. Once Mandrake has your starship hidden away somewhere safe, it'll be dropping the fact through every major corporate data port on Sanction 4. Han's going to use this to swing instant membership of the cartel and probably a seat on the Protectorate Commercial Council into the bargain. Mandrake will be a major player overnight. Our significance in that particular scheme of things will be nil.
Got it all worked out, huh?
I shrugged again. This isn't anything we haven't already discussed.
No.
She made a small, oddly helpless gesture.
I just didn't think you'd be so fucking congenial with that piece of corporate shit.
I sighed. Look, my opinion of Matthias Hand is irrelevant. He'll do the job we want him to do. That's what counts. We've been paid, we're on board, and Hand has marginally more personality than the average corporate exec, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a blessing. I like him well enough to get on with. If he tries to cross us, I'll have no problem putting a bolt through his stack. Now, is that suitably detached for you? Wardani tapped the carapace of the scrambler.
You'd better hope this isn't tagged. If Hand's listening to you...
Well... I reached across her and picked up Schneider's untouched drink. If he is, he's probably having similar thoughts about me. So cheers, Hand, if you can hear me. Here's to mistrust and mutual deterrence. I knocked back the rum and upended the glass on the scrambler. Wardani rolled her eyes.
Great. The politics of despair. Just what I need.
What you need, I said, yawning, is some fresh air. Want to walk back to the tower? If we leave now, we should make it before curfew.
I thought in that uniform the curfew wasn't an issue.
I looked down at the black jacket and fingered the cloth. Yeah, well, probably isn't, but we're supposed to be profiling low right now. And besides, if you get an automated patrol, machines can be bloody-minded about these things. Better not to risk it. So what do you think? Want to walk?
Gonna hold my hand?
It was meant to be a joke, but it came out wrong. We both stood up and were abruptly, awkwardly inside each other's personal space. The moment stumbled between us like an uninvited drunk. I turned to crush out my cigarette.
Sure,
I said, trying for lightness. It's dark out there. I pocketed the scrambler and stole back my cigarettes in the same movement. But my words had not dispersed the tension. Instead, they hung there like the afterimage of laser fire. It's dark out there. Outside, we both walked with hands crammed securely into pockets. Chapter 12. The top three floors of the Mandrake Tower were executive residential, access barred from below and topped off with a multi-level roof complex of gardens and cafes. A variable permeate power screen strung from parapet pylons kept the sun fine-tuned for luminous warmth throughout the day, and in three of the cafes, you could get breakfast at any hour. We got it at midday and were still working our way through the last of the spread when an immaculately attired Hand came looking for us. If he'd been listening in on last night's character assassination, it didn't seem to have upset him much.
"Good morning, Mr. Swardani, gentlemen. I trust your night out on the town proved worth the security risk."
Had its moments. I reached out and speared another dim sum parcel with my fork, not looking at either of my companions. Wardani had in any case retreated behind her sun lenses the moment she sat down, and Schneider was brooding intently on the dregs in his coffee cup. The conversation had not been sparkling so far.
"Sit down. Help yourself."
"Thank you."
Hand hooked out a chair and seated himself. On closer inspection, he looked a little tired around the eyes.
"I've already had lunch. Mr. Swardani, the primary components from your hardware list are here. I'm having them brought up to your suite."
The archaeologue nodded and turned her head upward to the sun. when it became apparent that this was going to be the full extent of her response, Han turned his attention to me and cranked up an eyebrow. I shook my head slightly. Don't ask. Well, we're about ready to recruit, Lieutenant, if you... Fine. I washed down the dim sum with a short swallow of tea and got up. The atmosphere around the table was getting to me. Let's go. No one said anything. Schneider didn't even look up. But Wardani's blacked-out sun lenses tracked my retreat across the terrace like the blank faces of a sentry gun sensor. We rode down from the roof in a chatty elevator that named each floor for us as we passed it, and outlined a few of Mandrake's current projects on the way. Neither of us spoke, and a scant 30 seconds later the doors recessed back on the low ceiling and raw, fused glass walls of the basement level. Aluminum strips cast a bluish light on the fusing, and on the far side of the open space a blob of hard sunlight signaled an exit. Parked carelessly opposite the elevator doors, a nondescript straw-colored cruiser was waiting. "Taisa was defueled," said Hand, leaning into the driver's compartment. "The soul market." The engine note dialed up from idle to a steady thrum. We climbed in and settled back into the autumn-old cushioning as the cruiser lifted and spun like a spider on a thread. Through the unpolarized glass of the cabin divider and past the shaven head of the driver, I watched the blob of sunlight expand as we rushed softly toward the exit. Then the light exploded around us in a hammering of gleam on metal, and we spiraled up into the merciless blue desert sky above landfall. After the muted atmospheric shielding on the roof level, there was a slightly savage satisfaction to the change. Han touched a stud on the door, and the glass polarized blue. "You were followed last night," he said matter-of-factly. I glanced across the compartment at him. "What for? We're on the same side, aren't we?" "Not by us." He made an impatient gesture. "Well, yes, by us. By overhead, of course. That's how we spotted them. But I'm not talking about that. This was low-tech stuff. You and Wardani came home separated from Schneider, which, incidentally, wasn't all that intelligent, and you were shadowed. One on Schneider, but he peeled off, presumably as soon as he saw Wardani wasn't coming out. The others went with you as far as Fine Alley, just out of sight of the bridge." "How many?" "Three. Two full human, one Battletech cyborg, by the way it moved." "Did you pick them up?" "No." Hand wrapped one lightly closed fist against the window. "The duty machine only had protect and retrieve parameters. By the time we were notified, they'd gone to ground near the Latimer Canal head, and by the time we got there, they were gone. We looked, but..." He spread his hands. The tiredness around the eyes was making some sense. He'd been up all night trying to safeguard his investment. "What are you grinning about?" "Sorry. Just touched. Protect and retrieve, huh?" "Ha, ha." He fixed me with a stare until my grin showed some signs of ebbing. "So, is there something you want to tell me?" I thought briefly of the camp commandant and his current stunned mumblings about an attempt to rescue Tanya Wardani. I shook my head. "Are you certain?" "Hand, be serious. If I'd known someone was shadowing me, do you think they'd be in any better state now than Deng and his goons?" "So who were they?" "I thought I just told you I didn't know. Street scum, maybe?" He gave me a pained look. "Street scum following a Carrera's Wedge uniform." "Okay, maybe it was a manhood thing. Territorial. You've got some gangs in Landfall, haven't you?" "Kovach, please. You be serious. If you didn't notice them, how likely is it they were that low grade?" I sighed. "Not very." "Precisely. So who else is trying to carve themselves a slice of artifact pie?" "I don't know," I admitted gloomily. The rest of the flight passed in silence. Finally, the cruiser banked about and I tipped a glance out the window. We were spiraling down toward what looked like a sheet of dirty ice littered with used bottles and cans. I frowned and recalibrated for scale. "Are these the original?" Hand nodded. "Some of them, yes, the big ones. The rest are impounds, stuff from when the bottom fell out of the artifact market. Soon as you can't pay your landing slot,
They grab your haulage and grav lift it out here until you do. Of course, with the way the market went, hardly anyone bothered even trying to pay off what they owed. So the Port Authority salvage crews went in and decommissioned them with plasma cutters. We drifted in over the nearest of the grounded colony barges. It was like floating across a vast felled tree. Up at one end, the thrust assemblies that had propelled the vessel across the gulf between Latimer and Sanction IV were spread like branches, crushed to the landing field underneath, and fanned stiffly against the hard blue sky above. The barge would never lift again, had in fact never been intended for more than a one-way trip. Assembled in orbit around Latimer a century ago, built only for the long blast across interstellar space and a single planetfall at Journey's End, she would have burned out her anti-grav landing system coming down. The detonation of the final touchdown repulsor jets would have fused the desert sand beneath into an oval of glass that would eventually be extended by engineers to join the similar ovals left by other barges, and so create Ta Sawasdi Field to serve the fledgling colony for the first decade of its life. By the time the corporates got around to building their own private fields and the associated complexes, the barges would have been gutted, used initially to live out of, then as a ready source of refined alloys and hardware to build from. On Harlan's world, I'd been inside a couple of the original Conrad Harlan fleet, and even the decks had been cannibalized, carved back to multi-leveled ridges of metal clinging to the inner curve of the hull. Only the hulls themselves were ever left intact, out of some bizarre quasi-reverence of the kind that in earlier ages got successive generations to give up their lives to build cathedrals. The cruiser crossed the spine of the barge and slid down the curve of the hull to a soft landing in the pool of shadow the grounded vessel cast by. We climbed out into sudden cool, and a quiet broken only by the whisper of a breeze across the glass plain, and, faintly, the human sounds of commerce from within the hull. This way. Hand nodded at the curving wall of alloy before us, and strode in toward a triangular cargo vent near ground level. I caught myself scanning the edifice for possible sniper points, shrugged off the reflex irritably, and went after him. The wind swept detritus obligingly out of my way in little knee-high swirls. Close up, the cargo vent was huge, a couple of meters across at its apex and wide enough at base to permit the passage of a trolleyed Marauder bomb fuselage. The loading ramp that led up to the entrance had doubled as a hatch when the barge was in flight, and now squatted on massive hydraulic haunches that hadn't worked in decades. At the top, the vent was flanked with carefully blurred holographic images that might have been either Martians or angels in flight. "Dig, Art," Hans said disparagingly. Then we were past them, and into the vaulted gloom beyond. It was the same feeling of decayed space that I'd seen on Harlan's world. But where the Harlan fleet hulks had been preserved with museum sobriety, this space was filled with a chaotic splatter of color and sound. Stalls built from brightly primary plastics and wire were cabled and epoxied seemingly at random up the curve of the hull and across what remained of the principal decks, giving the impression that a colony of poisonous mushrooms had infected the original structure. Sawn-off sections of companionway and ladders of welded support struts linked it all together. Here and there, more holographic art lent extra flair to the glow of lamps and aluminum strips. Music wailed and basslined unpredictably from hull-mounted speakers the size of crates. High above it all, someone had punched meter-wide holes in the hull alloy so that beams of solid sunlight blasted through the gloom at tall angles. At the impact point of the closest beam stood a tall, raggedly dressed figure, sweat-beaded black face turned up to the light as if it were a warm shower. There was a battered black top hat jammed on his head, and an equally well-used long black coat draped across his gaunt frame. He heard our steps on the metal and pivoted, arms held cruciform. "Ah, gentlemen!" The voice was a prosthetic bubbling, emitted by a rather obvious leech unit stapled to the scarred throat. "You are just in time. I am Cemeter. Welcome to the Soul Market." Up on the axial deck, we got to watch the process begin.
As we stepped out of the cage elevator, Cemetery moved aside and gestured with one rag-feathered arm. "Behold," he said. Out on the deck, a tracked cargo loader was backing up with a small scoop held high in its lifting arms. As we watched, the scoop tilted forward and something started to spill over the lip, cascading onto the deck and bouncing up again with a sound like hailstones. Cortical stacks. It was hard to tell without racking up the Nurichem vision, but most of them looked too bulky to be clean. Too bulky, and too whitish-yellow with the fragments of bone and spinal tissue that still clung to the metal. The scoop hinged farther back, and the spillage became a rush, a coarse, white-noised outpouring of metallic shingle. The cargo loader continued to backtrack, laying a thick, spreading trail of the stuff. The hailstorm built to a quick drumming fury, then choked up as the continuing cascade of stacks was soaked up by the mounds that had already fallen. The scoop upended, emptied. The sound stopped.
"Just in," observed Cemetery, leading us around the spillage. "Mostly from the Sukinda bombardment, civilians and regular forces, but there are bound to be some rapid deployment casualties as well. We're picking them up all over the east. Someone misread Kemp's ground cover pretty badly."
"Not for the first time," I muttered.
"Nor the last, we hope."
Cemetery crouched down and scooped up a double handful of cortical stacks. The bone clung to them in patches like yellow-stained rime.
"Business has rarely been this good."
Something scraped and rattled in the dimly lit cavern. I looked up sharply, chasing the sound. All the way around the extended mound, traders were moving in with shovels and buckets, elbowing at each other for a better place at the digging. The shovel blades made a grating, scraping sound as they bit in, and each flung shovel load rattled in the buckets like gravel. For all the competition for access, I noticed they gave Cemetery a wide berth. My eyes turned back to the top-hatted figure crouched in front of me, and his scarred face split in a huge grin, as if he could feel my gaze. Enhanced peripherals, I guessed. And I watched as, still smiling gently, he opened his fingers and let the stacks trickle back into the pile. When his hands were empty again, he brushed the palms off against each other and stood.
"Most sell by gross weight," he murmured. "It is cheap and simple. Talk with them if you will. Others scan out the civilians for their customers, the chaff from the military wheat, and the price is still low. Perhaps this will be sufficient for your needs, or perhaps you need Cemetery."
"Get to the point," Han said curtly. Beneath the battered top hat, I thought the eyes narrowed fractionally, but whatever was in that tiny increment of anger never made it into the rag-wrapped black man's voice.
"The point," he said courteously, "is as it always is. The point is what you desire. Cemetery sells only what those who come to him desire. What do you desire, Mandrake Man? You and your wedge wolf?"
I felt the mercury shiver of the Nurichem go through me. I was not wearing my uniform. Whatever this man was racked with, it was more than enhanced peripherals. Han said something in a hollow-syllabled language I didn't recognize, and made a small sign with his left hand. Cemetery stiffened.
"You are playing a dangerous game," the Mandrake exec said quietly, "and the charade is at an end. Is that understood?"
Cemetery stood immobile for a moment, and then his grin broke out again. With both hands, he reached symmetrically into his ragged coat and found himself looking down the barrel of a Kalashnikov interface gun from a range of about 5 centimeters. My left hand had put the weapon there without conscious thought. "Slowly," I suggested.
"There is no problem here, Kovach."
Han's voice was mild, but his eyes were still locked with Cemetery's.
"The family ties have been established now."
Cemetery's grin said that wasn't so, but he withdrew his hands from under the coat slowly enough. Gripped delicately in each palm was what looked like a live gunmetal crab. He looked from one set of gently flexing segmented legs to the other, and then back down the barrel of my gun.
If he was afraid, it didn't show. What is it you desire, company man? Call me that again, and I might be forced to pull this trigger. He's not talking to you, Kovach. Hand nodded minimally at the Kalashnikov, and I stowed it. Spec Ops Cemetery. Fresh kills. Nothing over a month. And we're in a hurry. Whatever you've got on the slab. Cemetery shrugged. The freshest are here, he said, and tossed the two crab remotes down on the mound of stacks, where they commenced spidering busily about, picking up one tiny metal cylinder after another in delicate mandibular arms, holding each one beneath a blue glowing lens, and then discarding it. But if you are pressed for time... He turned aside and led us to a somberly appointed stall where a thin woman, as pale as he was dark, hunched over a workstation, stress-blasting bone fragments from a shallow tray of stacks. The tiny, high-pitched fracturing sound as the bone came off ran a barely audible counterpoint to the bass-throated bite, crunch, rattle of the prospector's shovels and buckets behind us. Cemetery spoke to the woman in the tongue Hand had used earlier, and she unwound herself languidly from among the cleaning tools. From a shelf at the back of the stall, she lifted a dull metal canister about the size of a surveillance drone and carried it out to us. Holding it up for inspection, she tapped with one overlong black-painted fingernail at a symbol engraved in the metal. She said something in the language of echoing syllables. I glanced at Hand. The Chosen of Ogon, he said, without apparent irony. Protected in iron for the Master of Iron and of War. Warriors. He nodded, and the woman set down the canister. From one side of the workstation she brought a bowl of perfumed water, with which she rinsed her hands and wrists. I watched fascinated as she laid newly wet fingers on the lid of the canister, closed her eyes, and intoned another string of cadenced sounds. Then she opened her eyes and twisted the lid off. How many kilos do you want? Asked Cemetery, incongruously pragmatic against the backdrop of reverence. Hand reached across the table and scooped a handful of stacks out of the canister. They gleamed silvery clean in the cup of his hand. How much are you going to gut me? 79.50 the kilo. The exec grunted. Last time I was here, Pravit charged me 47.50, and he was apologetic about it. That's a dross price, and you know it, company man. Cemetery shook his head, smiling. Pravit deals with unsorted product, and he doesn't even clean it most of the time. If you want to spend your valuable corporate time picking bone tissue off a pile of civilian and standard conscript stacks, then go and haggle with Pravit. These are selected warrior class, cleaned and anointed, and they are worth what I ask. We should not waste each other's time in this way. All right. Hand weighed the palmful of capsuled lives. You've got your expenses to think about. 60,000 flat. And you know I'll be back sometime. Sometime. Cemetery seemed to be tasting the word. Sometime. Joshua Kemp may put landfall to the nuclear torch. Sometime, company man. We may all be dead. We may, indeed. Hand tipped the stacks back into the canister. They made a clicking sound, like dice falling. And some of us, sooner than others, if we go around making anti-cartel statements about Kempist victory. I could have you arrested for that, Cemetery. The pale woman behind the workstation hissed and raised a hand to trace symbols in the air, but Cemetery snapped something at her, and she stopped. What would be the point in arresting me? He asked smoothly, reaching into the canister and extracting a single gleaming stack. Look at this. Without me, you'd have to fall back on Pravit. 70. 67.50, and I'll make you Mandrake's preferred supplier. Cemetery rolled the stack between his fingers, apparently musing. Very well, he said finally. 67.50, but that price comes with a set minimum, 5 kilos. Agreed. Hand produced a credit chip, hollow engraved with a Mandrake insignia.
As he gave it to Cemetery, he grinned unexpectedly. I was here for 10, anyway. Wrap them up. Cemetery tossed the stack back into the canister. He nodded at the pale woman, and she brought out a concave weighing plate from beneath the workstation. Tilting the canister and reaching inside with a reverent hand, she scooped out the stacks a palmful at a time and laid them gently in the curve of the plate. Ornate violet digits evolved in the air above the mounting pile. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught a glimpse of movement near ground level, and turned hurriedly to face it. "A find," Cemetery said lightly, and grinned. One of the crab-legged remotes had returned from the pile, and having reached Cemetery's foot, was working its way steadily up his trouser leg. When it reached the level of his belt, he plucked it off and held it still, while, with the other hand, he prized something from the thing's mandibles. Then he tossed the little machine away. It drew in its limbs as it sensed the free fall, and when it hit the deck, it was a featureless gray ovoid that bounced and rolled to a quick halt. A moment later, the limbs extended cautiously. The remote righted itself and scuttled off about its master's business.
Ah, look!
Cemetery was rubbing the tissue-flecked stack between his fingers and thumb, still grinning.
Look at that, Wedgewolf. Do you see? Do you see how the new harvest begins?
Chapter 13. The Mandrake AI read the stack-stored soldiers we'd bought as three-dimensional machine code data, and instantly wrote off a third as irretrievably psychologically damaged. Not worth talking to. Resurrected into virtuality, all they'd have done was scream themselves hoarse. Han shrugged it off.
That's about standard, he said. There's always some wastage, whoever you buy from. We'll run a psychosurgery dream sequencer on the others. That should give us a long short list without having to actually wake any of them up. Those are the want parameters.
I picked up the hard copy from the table and glanced through it. Across the conference room, the damaged soldier's data scrolled down on the wall screen in two-dimensional analog. Experience of high-rad combat environments? I looked up at the Mandrake exec. Is this something I should know about?
Come on, Kovach. You already do.
The flash would reach into the mountains, would chase the shadows out of gullies that hadn't seen light so harsh in geological eons. Had hoped it wouldn't turn out that way. Hand examined the tabletop as if it needed resheening.
We needed the peninsula cleared, he said carefully. By the end of the week it will be. Kemp's pulling back. Call it serendipity.
Once, on reconnaissance along a ridge on the slumped spine of Dangrek, I'd seen Sauberville sparkling far off in the late afternoon sun. There was too much distance for detail. Even with a Nurikem racked up to maximum, the city looked like a silver bracelet flung down at the water's edge, remote and unconnected with anything human. I met Han's eyes across the table.
So we're all going to die. He shrugged. It seems unavoidable, doesn't it? Going in that soon after the blast. I mean, we can use clone stock with high tolerance for the new recruits, and anti-rad medication will keep us all functional for the time it takes, but in the long run...
Yeah, well, in the long run, I'll be wearing out a designer sleeve in Latimer City.
Quite.
What kind of rad-tolerant sleeves you have in mind? Another shrug.
Don't know for sure. I'll have to talk to BioWare. Maori stock, probably.
Why? Want one? I felt the Kumalo bioplates twitch in the flesh of my palms, as if angry, and shook my head. I'll stick with what I've got, thanks.
You don't trust me?
Now you come to mention it, no, but that isn't it. I jabbed a thumb at my own chest. This is Wedge Custom. Kumalo Biosystems. They don't build better for combat than this stuff.
And the anti-rad?
It'll hold up long enough for what we have to do. Tell me something, Hand. What are you offering the new recruits long-term? Aside from a new sleeve that may or may not stand up to the radiation, what do they get when we're done? Hand frowned at the question.
Well, employment.
They had that. Look where it got them.
Employment in landfall.
For some reason, the derision in my voice seemed to be chewing at him. Or maybe something else was. contracted security staff from Mandrake, guaranteed for the duration of the war or 5 years, whichever lasts longer. Does that meet your quellest, man of the downtrodden, anarchist scruples?
I raised an eyebrow. Those are three very tenuously connected philosophies, Hand, and I don't really subscribe to any of them. But if you're asking, does it sound like a good alternative to being dead? I'd say so. If it were me, I'd probably want in at that price.
A vote of confidence. Han's tone was withering. How reassuring.
Provided, of course, I didn't have friends and relatives in Sauberville. You might want to check for that in the back data.
He looked at me. Are you trying to be funny?
I can't think of anything very funny about wiping out an entire city. I shrugged. Just now, anyway. Maybe that's just me.
Ah, so this is a moral qualm rearing its ugly head, is it?
I smiled thinly. Don't be absurd, Hand. I'm a soldier.
Yes, it might be as well to remember that. And don't take your surplus feelings out on me, Kovach. As I said before, I'm not actually calling in the strike on Sauberville. It is merely opportune.
Isn't it just? I tossed the hard copy back across the table, trying not to wish it were a fused grenade. So let's get on with it. How long to run this dream sequencer?
According to the psychosurgeons, we act more in keeping with our true selves in a dream than in any other situation, including the throes of orgasm and the moment of our deaths. Maybe that explains why so much of what we do in the real world makes so little sense.
It certainly makes for fast psych evaluation.
The dream sequencer, combined in the heart of the Mandrake AI with the want parameters and a Sauberville-related background check, went through the remaining 7 kilos of functional human psyche in less than 4 hours. It gave us 387 possibles, with a high probability core of 212.
Time to wake them up, said Hand, flipping through profiles on screen and yawning.
I felt my jaw muscles flexing in unwilling sympathy. Perhaps out of mutual mistrust, neither of us had left the conference room while the sequencer ran, and after edging around the subject of Sauberville a bit more, we hadn't had that much to say to each other either. My eyes were itchy from watching the data scroll down and not much else. My limbs twitched with a desire for some physical exertion, and I was out of cigarettes. The impulse to yawn fought for control of my face.
Do we really have to talk to all of them?
Hand shook his head.
No, we really don't. There's a virtual version of me in the machine with some psychosurgeon peripherals wired in. I'll send it in to bring back the best 12.5. That's if you trust me that far.
I gave it up and yawned, finally, cavernously. Trust enabled. You want to get some air and a coffee?
We left for the roof. Up on top of the Mandrake Tower, the day was inking out to a desert indigo dusk. In the east, stars poked through the vast expanse of darkening Sanction 4 sky. At the western horizon, it seemed as though the last of the sun's juice was being crushed from between thin strips of cloud by the weight of the settling night. The shields were way down, letting in most of the evening's warmth, and a faint breeze out of the north. I glanced around at the scattering of Mandrake personnel and the roof garden Hand had chosen. They formed pairs or small groups at the bars and tables, and talked in modulated, confident tones that carried a Manglic corporate standard sewn with the sporadic local music of Thai and French. No one appeared to be paying us any attention. The language mix reminded me.
Tell me, Hand.
I broke the seal on a new pack of landfill lights and drew one to life.
What was that shit out of the market today?
That language the three of you were speaking, the left-handed gestures.
Hand tasted his coffee and set it down.
You haven't guessed.
Voodoo?
You might put it that way. The pained look on the exec's face told me he wouldn't put it that way in a million years. Though, properly speaking, it hasn't been called that for several centuries. Neither was it called that back at the origin. Like most people who don't know, you're oversimplifying.
I thought that was what religion was. Simplification for the heart of thinking.
He smiled. If that is the case, then the heart of thinking seem to be in a majority, do they not?
They always are.
Well, perhaps. Han drank more coffee and regarded me over the cup.
"You really claim to have no god, no higher power. The Harlanites are mostly Shintoists, aren't they? That or some Christian offshoot?"
"I'm neither," I said flatly.
"Then you have no refuge against the coming of night, no ally when the immensity of creation presses down on the spine of your tiny existence like a stone column 1,000 meters tall?"
I was at Inan in hand. I knocked ash off the cigarette and gave him back his smile, barely used. At Inan I heard soldiers with columns about that tall on their backs screaming for a whole spectrum of higher powers. None of them showed up that I noticed. Allies like that I can live without.
God is not ours to command.
Evidently not. Tell me about Cemeter. That hat and coat, he's playing a part, right?
Yes.
There was a cordial distaste leaking into Han's voice now.
He has adopted the guise of Gede, in this case the Lord of the Dead.
Very witty.
In an attempt to dominate the weaker-minded among his competitors. He is probably an adept of sorts, not without a certain amount of influence in the spirit realm, though certainly not enough to call up that particular personage. I am somewhat more... He offered me a slight smile. Accredited, shall we say. I was merely making that clear. Presenting my credentials, you might say, and establishing the fact that I found his act in poor taste.
Strange this Gede hasn't gotten around to making the same point, isn't it?
Han sighed. Actually, it's very likely that Gede, like you, sees the humor of the situation. For a wise one, he is very easily amused.
Really? I leaned forward, searching his face for some trace of irony. You believe this shit, right? I mean, seriously?
The Mandrake exec watched me for a moment, then tipped back his head and gestured at the sky above us. Look at that, Kovach. We're drinking coffee so far from Earth you have to work hard to pick out Saul in the night sky. We were carried here on a wind that blows in a dimension we cannot see or touch. Stored as dreams in the mind of a machine that thinks in a fashion so far in advance of our own brains, it might as well carry the name of God. We have been resurrected into bodies not our own, grown in a secret garden without the body of any mortal woman. These are the facts of our existence, Kovach. How, then, are they different or any less mystical than the belief that there is another realm where the dead live in the company of beings so far beyond us? We must call them gods.
I looked away, oddly embarrassed by the fervor in Han's voice. Religion is funny stuff, and it has unpredictable effects on those who use it. I stubbed out my cigarette and chose my words with care. Well, the difference is that the facts of our existence weren't dreamed up by a bunch of ignorant priests centuries before anyone had left the Earth's surface or built anything resembling a machine. I'd say that on balance, that makes them a better fit than your spirit realm for whatever reality we find out here. Han smiled, apparently unoffended. He seemed to be enjoying himself.
That is a local view, Kovach.
Of course, all the remaining churches have their origins in pre-industrial times, but faith is a metaphor, and who knows how the data behind these metaphors has traveled, from where, and for how long. We walk amid the ruins of a civilization that apparently had godlike powers thousands of years before we could walk upright. Your own world, Kovach, is encircled by angels with flaming swords.
Whoa. I lifted my hands, palms out. Let's damp down the metaphor core for a moment. Harlan's world has a system of orbital battle platforms that the Martians forgot to decommission when they left.
Yes. Han gestured impatiently. Orbital is built of some substance that resists every attempt to scan it. Orbitals with the power to strike down a city or a mountain, but who forbear to destroy anything save those vessels that try to ascend into the heavens. What else is that but an angel?
It's a fucking machine, Han, with programmed parameters that probably have their basis in some kind of planetary conflict.
Can you be sure of that?
He was leaning across the table now. I found myself mirroring his posture as my own intensity was stoked. Had you ever been to Harlan's world, Han? No, I thought not. Well, I grew up there, and I'm telling you the orbitals are no more mystical than any other Martian artifact.
What? No more mystical than the song spires?
His voice dropped to a hiss.
Trees of stone that sing to the rising and setting sun. No more mystical than a gate that opens like a bedroom door onto...
He stopped abruptly and glanced around, face flushing with a near indiscretion. I sat back and grinned at him. Admirable passion for someone in a suit that expensive. So you're trying to sell me the Martians as voodoo gods, is that it?
I'm not trying to sell you anything, he muttered, straightening up.
And no, the Martians fit quite comfortably into this world. We don't need recourse to the places of origin to explain them. I'm just trying to show you how limited your worldview is without an acceptance of wonder.
I nodded.
Very good of you. I stabbed a finger at him. Just do me a favor, Hand. When we get where we're going, keep this shit stowed, will you? I'm going to have enough to worry about without you weirding out on me.
I believe only what I have seen, he said stiffly. I have seen Gede and Carafor walk among us in the flesh of men. I have heard their voices speak from the mouths of the Haugen. I have summoned them.
Yeah, right. He looked at me searchingly, offended belief melting slowly into something else. His voice loosened and flowed down to a murmur.
This is strange, Kovach. You have a faith as deep as mine. The only thing I wonder is why you need so badly not to believe.
That sat between us for almost a minute before I touched it. The noise from surrounding tables faded out, and even the wind out of the north seemed to be holding its breath. Then I leaned forward, speaking less to communicate than to dispel the laser-lit recall in my head.
You're wrong, Hand, I said quietly. I'd love to have access to all the shit you believe. I'd love to be able to summon someone who's responsible for this fuck-up of a creation, because then I'd be able to kill them. Slowly.
Back in the machine, Han's virtual self worked the long shortlist down to 11. It took nearly 3 months to do it. Run at the AI's top capacity of 350 times real time, the whole process was over shortly before midnight. By that time, the intensity of the conversation up on the roof had mellowed. First into an exchange of experiential reverie, a kind of rummaging around in the things we had seen and done that tended to support our individual worldviews, and thence to increasingly vague observations on life, threaded onto long mutual silences as we stared beyond the ramparts of the tower and out into the desert night. Han's pocket bleep broke into the powered-down mood like a note shattering glass. We went down to look at what we had, blinking in the suddenly harsh lights inside the tower, and yawning. Less than an hour later, as midnight turned over and the new day began, we turned off Han's virtual self and uploaded ourselves into the machine in his place. Final Selection. Chapter 14. In recall, their faces come back to me. Not the faces of the beautiful rad-resistant Maori combat sleeves they wore up to Dangrek and the smoking ruins of Sabreville. Instead, I see the faces they owned before they died. The faces Cemetery claimed and sold back into the chaos of the war. The faces they remembered themselves as. The faces they presented in the innocuous hotel suite virtuality where I first met them. The faces of the dead. Ola Hansen. Ludicrously pale Caucasian. Cropped hair like snow. Eyes the calm blue of the digit displays on medical equipment and non-critical mode. Shipped in whole from Latimer with the first wave of cryo-capped UN reinforcements, back when everyone thought camp was going to be a 6-month pushover. This had better not be another desert engagement. There were still patches of sun-scorched red across his forehead and cheekbones. Because if it is, you can just put me back in the box. That cellular melanin itches like fuck.
It's cold where we're going, I assured him. Latimer City winter at warmest. You know your team is dead.
A nod. Saw the flash from the copter. Last thing I remember. It figures. Captured Marauder bomb. I told them to just blow the motherfucker where it lay. You can't talk those things around. Too stubborn. Hansen was part of a crack demolitions unit called the Soft Touch. I'd heard of them on the Wedge grapevine. They had a reputation for getting it right most of the time. Had. You gonna miss them? Hansen turned in his seat and looked across the virtual hotel room to the hospitality unit. He looked back at Hand. May I? Help yourself. He got up and went to the forest of bottles, selected one, and poured amber liquid into a tumbler until it was brim full. He raised the drink in our direction, lips tight and blue eyes snapping. Here's to the Soft Touch, wherever their fragmented fucking atoms may be. Epitaph. They should have listened to fucking orders. They'd fucking be here now. He poured the drink down his throat in a single smooth motion, grunted deep in his throat, and tossed the glass away across the room underhand. It hit the carpeted floor with an undramatic thump and rolled to the wall. Hansen came back to the table and sat down. There were tears in his eyes. But I guess that was the alcohol. Any other questions? He asked, voice ripped. Yvette Cruikshank, a 22-year-old, face so black it was almost blue, bone structure that belonged somewhere on the forward profile of a high-altitude interceptor, a dreadlocked mane gathered up the height of a fist before it spilled back down, hung with dangerous-looking steel jewelry and a couple of spare quick-plant plugs, coated green and black. The jacks at the base of her skull showed three more. What are those? I asked her.
Lingua Pack, Thai and Mandarin, Ninth Dan Shotokan.
She fingered her way up the braille-tagged feathers in a fashion that suggested she could probably rip and change blind and under fire.
Advance Field Medic.
And the ones in your hair?
Sat-nav interface and concert violin.
She grinned.
Not much call for that one recently, but it keeps me lucky.
Her face fell with comic abruptness that made me bite my lip.
Ket, you've requested rapid deployment posts 7 times in the last year, said Hand. Why is that?
She gave him a curious look.
You already asked me that.
Different me.
Oh, I get it. Ghost in the machine. Yeah, well, like I said before, closer focus, more influence over combat outcomes, better toys. You know, you smiled more the last time I said that.
Zhang Zhangping. Pale Asiatic features, intelligent eyes with a slightly inward cast, and a light smile. You had the impression that he was contemplating some subtly amusing anecdote he'd just been told. Aside from the calloused edges of his hands and a looseness of stance below his black coveralls, there was little to hint at his trade. He looked more like a slightly weary teacher than someone who knew 57 separate ways to make a human body stop working.
This expedition, he murmured, is presumably not within the general ambit of the war. It is a commercial matter, yes?
I shrugged. Whole war is a commercial matter, Zhang.
You may believe that. So may you, Han said severely. I am privy to government communiques at the highest level, and I'm telling you, without the cartel, the Kempists would have been in landfall last winter.
Yes, that is what I was fighting to prevent.
He folded his arms.
That is what I died to prevent.
Good, Han said briskly. Tell us about that.
I've already answered this question. Why do you repeat it?
The Mandrake exec rubbed at his eye. That wasn't me. It was a screening construct. There hasn't been time to review the data, so please.
It was a night assault in the Da Nang Plain, a mobile relay station for the Kempist's Marauder Bomb Management System.
You were part of that? I looked at the ninja in front of me with new respect. In the Da Nang Theater, the covert strikes on Kemp's communications net were the only real success the government could claim in the last 8 months. I knew soldiers whose lives had been saved by the operation. The propaganda channels had still been trumpeting the news of strategic victory about the time my platoon and I were getting shot to pieces up on the northern rim.
I was honored enough to be appointed cell commander.
Hand looked at his palm, where data was scrolling down like some mobile skin disease. Systems magic. Virtual toys.
Your cell achieved its objectives, but you were killed when they pulled out. How did that happen?
I made a mistake. Zhang enunciated the words with the same distaste he had used to pronounce Kemp's name. And what was that? No one could have given the Mandrake exact points for tact.
I believe the automated sentry systems would deactivate when the station was blown. They did not.
Oops. He flicked a glance at me.
My cell could not withdraw without cover. I stayed behind.
Hand nodded. Admirable.
It was my error, and it was a small price to pay to halt the Kempist advance.
You're not a big Kemp fan, are you, Jiang? I kept my tone careful. It looked as if we had a believer here.
The Kempists preach a revolution, he said scornfully. But what will change if they take power on Sanction 4?
I scratched my ear. Well, there'll be a lot more statues of Joshua Kemp in public places, I imagine. Apart from that, probably not much.
Exactly. And for this he has sacrificed how many hundreds of thousands of lives?
Hard to say. Look, Zhang, we're not Kempists. If we get what we want, I can promise you there'll be a big renewed interest in making sure Kemp gets nowhere near power on Sanction 4. Will that do? He placed his hands flat on the table and studied them for a while.
Do I have an alternative?
He asked. Amelie Vongsavath. A narrow, hawk-nosed face the color of tarnished copper. Hair and a tidy pilot cut that was growing out, henna streaking black. At the back, tendrils of it almost covered the silvered sockets that would take the flight symbiote cables. Beneath the left eye, black tattooed crosshatching marked the cheekbone where the data flow filaments would go in. The eye above was a liquid crystal gray, mismatched with the dark brown of the right-hand pupil.
"Hospital stock,"
she said when her augmented vision noticed where I was looking.
"I took some fire over Buchinery Town last year, and it blew out the data flow. They patched me up in orbit."
"You flew back out with blown data feeds?" I asked skeptically. The overload would have shattered every circuit in her cheekbone and scorched tissue for half a handbreadth in every direction. "What happened to your autopilot?" She grimaced.
"Fried."
"So how did you run the controls in that state?"
"I shut down the machine and flew it on manual. Cut back to basic thrust and trim. This was a Lockheed Matoma. Their controls still run manually if you do that."
"No, I mean, how did you run the controls in the state you were in?"
"Oh."
She shrugged.
"I have a high pain threshold."
"Right." Luke Dupre. Tall and untidy. Sandy blonde hair grown longer than made sense for a battlefield, and in nothing you'd call a style. Face made up of sharp Caucasian angles, long bony nose, lantern jaw, eyes a curious shade of green, sprawled at ease in the virtual chair, head tilted to one side as if he couldn't quite make us out in this light. "So." He acquired my landfall lights from the table with a long arm and shook one out of the pack.
"You gonna tell me something about this gig?"
"No," said Hand. "It's confidential until you're on board." A throaty chuckle amid smoke as he puffed the cigarette to life.
"That's what you said last time. And like I said to you last time, who the hell am I gonna tell, man? You don't want to hire me, I'm going straight back into the tin can, right?"
"Nonetheless."
"All right. So you want to ask me something?"
"Tell us about your last covert assault tag," I suggested.
"That's confidential."
He surveyed our unsmiling faces for a moment.
"Hey, that was a joke. I already told your partner all about it. Didn't he brief you?"
I heard Hand make a compressed sound.
That was a construct," I said hurriedly. "We're hearing this for the first time. Run through it again for us."
Dupre shrugged.
"Sure, why not? Was a hit on one of Kemp's sector commanders, inside his cruiser."
"Successful?" He grinned at me.
"I would say so. The head, you know, it came off."
"I just wondered, you being dead and all."
"That was bad luck. The fuck's blood was deterrent toxin loaded. Slow acting. We didn't find out until we were airborne and heading out."
Hand frowned. "You got splashed?"
"Nah, man."
A pained expression flitted across the angular face.
"My partner. She caught the spray when the carotid went. Right in the eyes."
He plumed smoke at the ceiling.
"Too bad. She was our pilot."
"Ah."
"Yeah. we flew into the side of a building.
He grinned again.
That was fast acting, man.
Marcus Succiati. Beautiful, with an uncanny geometric perfection of feature that could have sat alongside Lapinet somewhere in the net. Eyes almond in shade and shape, mouth a straight line, face tending toward an inverted isosceles triangle, blunted at its corners to provide the solid chin and wide forehead, straight black hair plastered down. Features curiously immobile, as if drugged into detachment. A sense of energy conserved, of waiting. The face of a global pinup who'd played too much competition poker recently.
Boo!
I couldn't resist it. The almond eyes barely flickered.
There are serious charges outstanding against you, said Hand, with a reproachful glance in my direction.
Yes.
We all waited for a moment, but Succiati clearly didn't think there was any more to say on the subject. I started to like him. Hand threw out a hand like a conjurer, and a screen evolved into the air just beyond his splayed fingers. More fucking system magic. I sighed and watched as a head and shoulders in a uniform like mine evolved beside a downscroll of biodata. The face was familiar.
You murdered this man, Hand said coldly. Would you like to explain why?
No.
He doesn't have to. I gestured at the face on the screen. Dog Voighton gets a lot of people that way. I'm just interested to know how you managed to kill him. This time, the eyes lost some of their flatness, and his gaze glanced briefly off my wedge insignia, confused.
I shot him in the back of the head.
I nodded. Shows initiative. Is he really dead?
Yes. I used a sunjet on full charge.
Hand system magicked the screen away with a snap of his fingers.
Your brig shuttle may have been shot out of the sky, but the wedge think your stack probably survived. There's a reward posted for anyone who turns it up. They still want you for formal execution.
He looked sideways at me.
As I understand it, that tends to be a pretty unpleasant business.
Yeah, it is.
I'd seen a couple of these object lessons early on in my career with the Wedge. They took a long time.
I have no interest in seeing you handed over to the Wedge, said Hand. But I cannot risk this expedition on a man who will carry insubordination to these extremes. I need to know what happened.
Succiati was watching my face. I gave him the faintest hint of a nod.
He ordered my men decimated,
he said tightly. I nodded again, to myself this time. Decimation was, by all accounts, one of Voighton's favorite forms of liaison with local troops.
And why was that?
Oh, for fuck's sake, Hand!
I turned in my seat.
Didn't she hear him? He was ordered to decimate his command, and he didn't want to. That kind of insubordination I can live with.
There may be factors that...
We're wasting time,
I snapped, and turned back to Succiati. Given the same situation again, is there anything you'd do differently?
Yes.
He showed me his teeth. I'm not sure I'd call it a grin.
I'd have the sunjet on wide beam. That way, I'd have half-cooked his whole squad, and they wouldn't have been in any condition to arrest me.
I tipped a glance back at Hand. He was shaking his head, one hand up to his eyes. Sun Li Ping. Dark Mongol eyes shelved in epicanthic folds on high, broad cheekbones. A mouth poised in a faint downturn that might have been the aftermath of rueful laughter. Fine lines in the tan skin, and a solid fall of black hair draped over one shoulder and held firmly in place by a big silver static field generator. An aura of calm, equally unshakable.
You killed yourself?
I asked doubtfully.
So they tell me.
The downturned lips amped up to a crooked grimace.
I remember pulling the trigger. It's gratifying to know my aim doesn't deteriorate under pressure.
The slug from her sidearm had gone in under the right jawline, plowed directly through the center of the brain, and blown an admirably symmetrical hole in the top of her head on its way out. Hard to miss at that range, I said with experimental brutality. The calm eyes never flinched.
I understand it can be done, she said gravely.
Hand cleared his throat.
Would you like to tell us why you did it?
She frowned.
Again?
That, said Hand, through slightly gritted teeth, was a debriefing construct, not me.
Oh.
The eyes slanted sideways.